Welcome back, everyone. Ready for another deep dive?
Always.
This time, we're taking a closer look at the aftermath of Hurricanes Helene and Milton down in Florida. Specifically, the housing situation. See, it's been months since those storms hit, but for a lot of folks, rebuilding their lives, well, hasn't been easy. Not easy at all.
Yeah, the initial damage is just the beginning. It's the long-term recovery, especially finding a safe and affordable place to live that really tests a community.
We're going to hear some powerful stories today. Residents battling confusing rules from FEMA, folks in Pasco County facing delays getting their homes assessed. We're even going to talk about the challenges that renters face after a storm like this, something that doesn't always make the headlines.
It's fascinating, you know. Hurricanes like these, they don't just create destruction, they kind of expose the cracks that were already there. Things like affordable housing shortages, the risk of gentrification, those issues get magnified after a disaster.
Okay, let's start in Pinellas County, where, on top of everything else, residents are getting these letters from the county saying their homes are substantially damaged. It's got a lot of people worried.
Yeah, because that triggers FEMA's 50% rule, and that's where things can get tricky.
Okay, break that down for me. 50% rule, what does that even mean?
Basically, if the cost to repair your home is more than 50% of its market value, FEMA says you might have to make some big changes.
Big changes? Like what?
Elevate the house, maybe relocate it entirely, or in some cases, even demolish it.
Wow, that's intense.
Yeah, and it's causing a lot of anxiety because there's a real lack of clarity about how these costs are being calculated.
I bet. So not only are you dealing with the damage, now you have to worry about whether you can even afford to fix it.
Right, and in Pinellas, the county is using this FEMA estimator tool, but people are saying the numbers just don't add up.
Give me an example.
Sure. We've got John Ripter, a certified building contractor. He got a letter saying his repairs would be over $81,000, but he estimates it'll actually be closer to $20,000.
Whoa, that's a huge difference.
Right, so people are feeling like they're being hit with these massive bills without any real explanation, and, you know, John's a contractor himself, so if he's questioning these estimates...
Yeah, something doesn't seem right.
And it's not just the money. Think about the emotional impact. This is your home, maybe the place you've lived for years, and suddenly you're being told you might have to drastically change it or even tear it down.
That's heartbreaking. It's more than just a financial burden. It's a loss of your sense of place, your community.
Exactly. And the lack of clear communication from the county is making it even worse. People feel unheard, left in the dark.
I've even heard that some county commissioners are raising concerns about these letters and how it's impacting people.
It definitely highlights a bigger issue here. Disaster recovery, it can't just be about throwing money at the problem. You need empathy, clear communication, and a willingness to really listen to the needs of each community.
All right, let's shift gears now and head over to Pasco County, where it sounds like they're facing a different set of challenges.
Yeah, instead of these cost disputes, the big problem in Pasco seems to be delays and inconsistencies when it comes to getting those damage assessments done.
So some people are getting help quickly, while others are left waiting.
Exactly. It's like a lottery, and people are getting really frustrated.
We've got the Waltrip family, for example. Their house was so badly damaged that they were living in tents on their lawn for weeks. They kept waiting for a FEMA inspector, but nobody ever showed up.
It's awful. And think about that, trying to take care of your family, living in a tent, not knowing what's going to happen next.
It just adds to the stress and the trauma of what they've already been through.
And it wasn't until they contacted a local news station that FEMA finally took action.
Wow. So sometimes you have to go public just to get someone to pay attention.
It shouldn't be that way. And then you have folks like Steve Champan, who said he never even got an inspection, yet he received a letter with this damage estimate that he called outrageous.
So wait, no inspection, but they're still sending out estimates.
It seems so. And it's this lack of consistency, this lack of transparency that makes people lose faith in the system.
I can see why. Some people are waiting forever, some aren't even getting inspected, and yet they're receiving these estimates that seem totally random.
It just makes you feel helpless, you know? Like you have no control over your own situation.
Absolutely. And it really raises questions about fairness. Is everyone being treated equally? Are these assessments being done accurately?
We need a system that's clear, that's standardized, that makes sure everyone is treated fairly. And we need to make sure these damage assessments are done right, thoroughly, and accurately.
Okay, now, we've talked about homeowners, but let's not forget about the renters. Thousands of them also impacted by these hurricanes, facing their own set of challenges.
You're right. It's easy to overlook their stories, but they're just as important. And even if a renter's home wasn't damaged, hurricanes can completely upend the rental market.
So we're talking about what? Higher rents? More competition for apartments?
Exactly. It's almost like hurricanes create this perfect storm of housing instability.
Yeah.
You have all this demand for housing because people have been displaced, but then the supply goes down because some units are damaged or destroyed.
Classic supply and demand, but with real people's lives hanging in the balance.
And it happens after pretty much every major hurricane. Rents go up, affordability gets squeezed, and it often pushes out those who are already struggling to make ends meet.
It's like a double whammy. First, you're impacted by the storm itself, and then you're at risk of being priced out of your community during the recovery.
And it's not just about the immediate affordability issue, it's also the long-term risk of gentrification.
Explain that.
Well, when those lower-income renters are forced out, developers often see an opportunity. They come in, they rebuild, but it's with more expensive housing, targeting a wealthier demographic.
We've seen that happen before, haven't we?
Yeah, most notably in New Orleans after Katrina. A lot of those neighborhoods were never really rebuilt for the original residents. They were transformed, often becoming more upscale, less diverse.
It makes you wonder, what are the goals of disaster recovery? Are we just trying to put things back the way they were? Or should we be aiming for something better, something more just and equitable?
That's the big question, isn't it? And it's one we need to be asking ourselves, especially as we face more and more of these extreme weather events in the years to come. And you know, this kind of ties back to that 50% rule we were talking about. It can actually contribute to gentrification,
Yeah.
especially in communities that were already struggling.
Really? I hadn't thought about that. How does that work? It's not just about, building back bigger and fancier, right?
Right. It's more complicated than that. Imagine a neighborhood with older homes, maybe more modest homes. After a hurricane, some of them get labeled substantially damaged.
Okay, and then?
Well, for homeowners who are already struggling financially, the cost of elevating their home or meeting those new code requirements, it can be just too much, even with FEMA help.
So they end up having to sell.
Yeah, and who's the most likely buyer in that situation?
Developers.
Often, yes. They see the potential to come in, demolish that older structure, and build something much larger, newer, and way more expensive.
Which, of course, attracts a different kind of buyer, people with more money.
Exactly. It's a gradual process, but over time, you see the original residents, folks who may have lived there for generations, and getting priced out. The whole character of the neighborhood changes.
It's kind of a vicious cycle, isn't it? We talk about building back after a disaster, but we need to make sure that everyone benefits from that rebuilding, not just the wealthy.
I agree. Resilience isn't just about physical structures, it's about social and economic resilience too. It's about making sure that recovery efforts lift everyone up, not just those who are already doing well.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, let's go back to the renters for a minute. We talked about higher rents, eviction risks, but what happens to those who actually lose their homes completely? Where do they go?
That's when things get really tough. You know, the availability of affordable housing was already a problem in many areas, even before the hurricanes. Now you have thousands of people displaced, all competing for fewer and fewer units.
I can't imagine trying to find a place to live under those conditions, especially if you have kids, if you've lost everything.
And often it's the most vulnerable people who have the hardest time navigating this system, people with lower incomes, people with disabilities, those who don't speak English fluently.
So where do they turn? I mean, FEMA does offer some temporary housing assistance,
Well,
right?
they do, but it's often limited, and it's not meant to be a long-term solution.
And I've heard that even getting that assistance can be a nightmare.
Oh, the process can be incredibly bureaucratic. People waiting weeks, sometimes months, for their applications to be processed. And in the meantime, they're living in shelters, staying with relatives, some even living in their cars.
It's just heartbreaking. And it really exposes the gaps in our safety net, especially when we're facing a crisis of this scale.
And even if they do get that FEMA assistance, it's often not enough to cover the cost of rent in a market that's been inflated by the disaster.
So they're stuck, aren't they? They can't afford to stay, but they might not have the resources to go anywhere else either.
Exactly. It's a terrible situation, and it highlights the issue of equity, or rather, the lack of it. Because this recovery process, it doesn't impact everyone equally. Those who are already struggling before the storm, they tend to be hit the hardest. And they have the fewest options.
It's a systemic problem that needs a systemic solution,
Yeah.
right? It's not just about providing band-aids, it's about fixing the underlying issues that make people vulnerable in the first place.
Absolutely. We need more investment in affordable housing, we need stronger protections for renters, and we need policies that encourage the development of mixed-income communities.
It sounds like we need a real shift in how we think about housing, period.
Yeah. Housing is a human right. It's not just a commodity.
Well said. Okay, let's change gears a little bit here. We've been talking about the physical damage, the financial struggles, but let's not forget about the mental and emotional toll that these disasters take on people.
Absolutely. It's easy to focus on the logistics of rebuilding, but we can't forget about the trauma, the anxiety, the grief, the sense of loss that people experience.
Those stories we heard from folks in Florida, they really brought that home for me.
It's real. The sleepless nights, the constant worry, the strain it puts on relationships, it's a heavy burden to carry.
It's a reminder that recovery, true recovery, it's more than just rebuilding houses and roads. It's about rebuilding lives, rebuilding communities, rebuilding relationships. And that takes time. It takes support.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a deep understanding of what people are going through emotionally.
And trauma, it manifests in different ways for different people. There's no one-size-fits-all approach to healing.
So what can we do?
Well, we need to make sure that mental health resources are available and easy to access for anyone who needs them. Not just in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, but in the weeks, months, even years that follow.
Yeah. It's about creating that support network, that sense of community, where people feel safe talking about what they're going through and seeking help without shame.
Exactly. And recognizing that recovery is a journey, not a destination. Everyone heals at their own pace.
And it's our responsibility to make sure that no one is left behind on that journey. You know, as we dig into these issues, it strikes me how interconnected everything is. The physical damage, the economic hardship, the social upheaval, the emotional toll, it's all tangled up together.
It's a web, and it's a reminder that disasters don't discriminate, but they do expose the inequalities that already exist, making it that much harder for people who are already struggling to get back on their feet.
And that brings us back to that question of responsibility, doesn't it? What is our responsibility as individuals, as communities, as a society, to make sure that disaster recovery is equitable and truly effective? How do we make sure that no one gets left behind?
It's a big question, and it deserves some serious thought. What can we do? What steps can we take to create a system that's more resilient and just? A system that truly supports those who need it most?
Maybe we can start by changing how we think about disaster recovery altogether. It's not just about providing temporary relief. It's about addressing the root causes of vulnerability and creating communities that are stronger and more equitable in the long run.
It's about shifting our focus from reaction to prevention, from charity to solidarity, from thinking about disasters as isolated events to understanding that they're really symptoms of larger systemic issues, things like climate change, poverty, inequality.
And it's about working together across different communities, across different sectors, to create a future that's more sustainable and just for everyone. We've covered a lot today. It can feel, I don't know, kind of overwhelming thinking about solutions for these huge problems. Where do we even start?
Yeah, it's definitely complex, but I don't think it's hopeless. We talked about some policy ideas like those eviction moratoriums, investing in more affordable housing. But there's also a lot we can do as individuals, as communities, to make a difference.
Okay, so let's get practical. What can people do right now inspired by what we've learned today?
Well, one thing that really struck me is how important it is to be prepared. We saw how confusing all those FEMA rules and processes can be. So educating yourself before disaster hits is crucial.
It's like having a hurricane kit, but for paperwork.
Haha, exactly. Go to your county website, find out about flood zones, check your insurance policy, make sure you understand that 50% rule and how it might apply to you. Knowledge is power, especially when you're dealing with bureaucracy.
And it's not just about preparing yourself, right? We saw how important that sense of community was in those stories from Forest Hills.
Oh, absolutely. Get to know your neighbors, get involved in local organizations. Building those relationships now means you have a support system ready when you need it most.
So prepping your home and prepping your community, smart. What about those supply chain problems we discussed? Any advice there?
If you have the space, you know, maybe think about keeping a little stockpile of basic building materials. Drywall, paint, nails, those things become super valuable after a hurricane, and having some on hand could really help you get started on repairs quickly.
Makes sense. Like a mini version of what stores do to get ready for hurricane season.
Right. And remember, we can all advocate for change. Support candidates who prioritize things like affordable housing, climate action, disaster preparedness. Contact your representatives, make your voice heard.
It's easy to feel powerless in these situations, but those conversations, those connections with our elected officials, they really can make a difference.
Absolutely. And keep talking about these issues. Share what you learned from this deep dive with your friends, your family, your colleagues. The more informed we are as a society, the better equipped we'll be to push for real, lasting solutions.
Well said. As we wrap up this deep dive, I'm definitely feeling, I don't know, a lot of emotions. It's heavy stuff, but I also feel hopeful, you know, knowing there are things we can do.
Me too. I'm just really struck by the resilience of the people we've learned about today. Despite everything they face, they're rebuilding, they're supporting each other, they're fighting for a better future. It's inspiring.
It really is. It reminds us that even in the midst of disaster, that human spirit, that drive to connect and rebuild, it's powerful.
So as we move forward, let's remember that question we posed. What is our responsibility as individuals, as communities, as a society, to make sure that everyone has a chance to recover fairly and fully after a disaster? Let's not wait for the next hurricane to find those answers.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll be back soon to explore another important topic. Until then, stay curious, stay engaged, and stay resilient.